Welcome to Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. I'm your host, Skylar Jeremias. On today's episode, we'll dive deep into the U.S. biosimilars market landscape, a topic of growing importance as biosimilars offer significant potential for reducing healthcare costs and increasing access to life-saving therapies. Understanding the current legislative and regulatory environment is crucial, as it shapes the approval and adoption processes for biosimilars. We'll explore key factors affecting payer uptake and provider adoption of biosimilars in the U.S., such as economic considerations, clinical evidence, and market dynamics. These factors are vital for stakeholders aiming to effectively navigate the complex biosimilars landscape. Additionally, we'll examine the challenges and opportunities associated with biosimilars for stakeholders across the healthcare continuum, including manufacturers, payers, providers, and patients. Addressing these challenges and leveraging opportunities can enhance the impact of biosimilars on healthcare systems and patient outcomes, making this discussion essential for anyone involved in the healthcare industry. Joined by Dr. Kyle Noonan, a highly qualified expert who supports scientific and commercial consulting engagements at Cencora, helping manufacturers demonstrate the clinical and economic value of their products. His work includes outcomes research strategy, pre-approval information exchange, payer value proposition development, primary market research, pricing research, and market access strategy. Dr. Noonan has a diverse background with experience in various healthcare settings, including medical affairs within the biopharmaceutical industry, association management, consulting, and clinical trial research. He has extensive leadership experience with the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy and has presented numerous posters at AMCP conferences. Dr. Noonan holds a Doctor of Pharmacy from Mercer University and a Master's in Pharmaceutical Outcomes and Policy from the University of Florida. Welcome, Dr. Noonan. To start us off, what are the primary factors that drive payer decisions when considering biosimilar adoption, and how do these differ from decisions regarding originator biologics?
Yeah, so I think if you ask any healthcare decision maker, they'll probably tell you it's net cost, but I'm not so sure that's always 100% the case. I think if it was the case, we'd see rapid adoption of the cheapest option. And that's not to say that rebates are not meeting that threshold, making it, you know, the preferred option being the cheapest option. But, you know, I'd bargain that there's some complex contract dynamics at play, you know, other things that go into these contracts and the ultimate decision of which products to prefer. So, yes, I do think net cost overall is the key driving force in terms of what drives a lot of their decisions with biosimilars. But, you know, we don't want to discount the fact that there could be other things at play. You know, some of these manufacturers may have, you know, pipeline contracts and rebates that are triggered based on utilization and, you know, all those fun things that go into, you know, what we see on the formulary. So, but I think, you know, the clinical folks on that side, they probably are looking more at the net costs, or at least in theory they are. So then as far as how the decisions differ from the originator, I think the thing with biosimilars is that it doesn't so much. I believe that the landscape right now is resembling more of the competitive market dynamics where you'd see multiple branded products for a single class of drugs, and where there's multiple competitors. Only in this case, there's virtually no differentiation. So, you know, with a traditional branded product, you might see nuances from product to product, whereas the biosimilars are obviously going to be, you know, highly similar or the same across the class of drugs. And so, you know, some of these decisions may be going into some of these other, you know, wraparound services, patient support things that the manufacturers can offer to help make their biosimilar the most attractive choice.
How can different stakeholders work collaboratively with payers to enhance confidence and encourage broader adoption?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it really revolves around the education piece and then reducing the barriers. So to start with education, I think there needs to be a lot right now from the providers to the patients to even the payers. And I know that's something that can always rise to the top and sort of be easy to say. But unfortunately, I think just with the status of biosimilars right now, I think, it's convoluted, and I think we all understand why we have to create this terminology of a biosimilar and these different regulatory pathways that would be different from just calling something a generic. But unfortunately, I think it's ultimately undermining the concept of what biosimilars are supposed to be. And in a sense, I think ideally they're supposed to be akin to a generic. And you'll find that out really quickly when you try to describe a biosimilar to a layperson and try to explain that, these products are not generics, but they're a lot like them, but they might differ in some of these ways. And I think to someone with a scientific or clinical background, it does make sense because you understand it at the molecular level. But when you have someone who's not as well versed in science and biology, then it becomes something that is not easy to understand. And so I just think that this concept of education is paramount. I think that goes beyond just even the patients and the lay people and to providers too. I think there's a lot of providers out there that still struggle to grasp kind of the idea and how this may differ and then ultimately what it means for them and their patient. And then I also mentioned barriers, right? That kind of goes along with some of what I was just describing, right? I think we should work towards moving away from this concept of interchangeability and make everything interchangeable. And I think that I recently saw some headlines that we might be moving that direction. I think to reduce more of the barriers, we need to further incentivize the use of biosimilars, similar to like what Inflation Reduction Act did by offering larger percentage of the ASP for the providers to offer a biosimilar, things of that nature in terms of reimbursement and incentivize providers to use these products. We also need to consider broad coverage of all biosimilars. I think that we're seeing, payers might pick and choose a couple biosimilars to cover and instead of the whole class. In the generic market, oftentimes, you might have, three, four, five, six, seven generics being covered by a payer. And when you start to be choosy, right, it kind of takes away some of those pricing benefits that you'd see with, multiple drugs in a class. And then also another thing that might help reduce some of these barriers is just trying to go towards, a biosimilar first approach, right, on new start patients, policies that would really make it attractive for a patient to start on a biosimilar, because that's another barrier is that, once a patient's been on something and stabilized, providers and patients might be reluctant to get off of it unless there's an incentive, right? So if it's not a biosimilar first approach, or, these are, I guess, maybe two separate things, but you should have some sort of system that ensures that a patient might see a lower copay or can give confidence to the provider that there is an incentive to pushing them onto the biosimilar from the branded product. And so, that's a lot of things that I said, but I think there really needs to be a bit of a comprehensive, multifaceted approach in order to, enhance confidence and encourage broader adoption of these products.
What strategies have been effective in encouraging provider adoption of biosimilars? Are there specific therapeutic areas where adoption has been more successful than others?
Yeah, so I think again, it's just educating, but educating with evidence, right? Providers are scientists, so they want to see proof that they can rely on the biosimilar product, and they want to see the evidence on the safety and efficacy for switching products, so that they can be assured that their patient can receive similar, a similar product that they were getting. And that's really the thing is they don't want to be pushing patients onto a biosimilar and then the patient coming back and saying, they're having this problem. And I think, again, it's a little bit hypothetical right now. I think a lot of what I've seen is that, switching seems to be very safe and effective, but I don't think the providers are fully educated on this yet, right? They have a lot of questions. And a lot of times too, they want their questions answered on specific products. And so it's not always as simple as saying, we're seeing that switch switching doesn't seem to be a problem based on these studies. You know, they might want to see it with the specific products. And so, you know, that's one of those things that it just takes time to develop evidence and really have an assurance in the field that if they switch to a biosimilar, they're going to get a similar response in their patient. They also want to be assured that their patient's going to receive a similar level of patient support, right? Those wraparound services. They also want to have confidence that if they select a biosimilar, that it's going to be reliably available for the patient. You know, they don't want to switch it to this other manufacturer, you know, who just came to market, you know, that's a biosimilar, and then find out that they can only get the product for a couple months because, you know, this product had bigger than anticipated demand, right? That's the last thing they want, is to have their patients go through these issues and switching back and forth. And then finally, I think they want to be assured that it won't cost their patient any more money, and at least be similar. You know, I can't speak to specific examples, but you know, I've heard of cases where maybe a copay, you know, is more expensive for the biosimilar product, or you know, they just want to know ultimately that their patient's going to receive something that's going to be beneficial. And by beneficial, I mean just as safe, just as effective, and the same or less money, and that they can get it reliably. And then, in terms of specific therapeutic areas where adoption's been most successful, I think that's probably oncology is where we're seeing the greatest uptake in general. Again, can't speak to specific products, but oncology in general. And I think really some of it's due to the fact that these medications are usually physician-administered kind of medical benefit drugs. And so they're kind of just controlled within the healthcare system or in the hospital that they're receiving the treatment. And so it's really easy for a provider to say, you know, I want this biosimilar, because in that situation, you know, it probably doesn't make a difference, or the patient may not even know that whether they're getting the biosimilar or the branded product. But when you think about things that are in the outpatient setting where they have to go pick it up from a pharmacy and then be educated because they're going to be administering it, and maybe they find out that it looks different, or you know, it has a different you know, manufacturer they need to call if they have an issue or something like that. That's where I think there's a much more difficult and challenging situation for adoption of the biosimilars, just because you know, the ability to switch on and off. And so I think that kind of plays into it. It kind of biases oncology to be a better situation on top of the high cost of oncology care in general. I think people are looking for something to lower costs, and those costs are you know, more reflective of the providers and the health system, and they're trying to manage those costs within the hospital. And so the onus is on them, whereas in the outpatient setting, you know, they may not be as incentivized to control the cost, and may not have as big of an incentive to switch over to that biosimilar when they're outpatient.
What are the biggest challenges stakeholders face in bringing biosimilars to market and ensuring their acceptance across the healthcare continuum?
Yeah, so I think it's always going to be this fundamental challenge that biosimilars offer, is it's, you know, how do you tell an appealing value story of a product about something that's meant to be virtually identical to its competitor, right? I think, you know, if you cannot tell a clinical value story, which in the biosimilar case, you really can't, because if it's functioning properly, it should be doing the exact same thing as its competitors and its reference product. So when you can't tell that clinical value story, you're really left with, you know, just some of these like external factors to the specific molecule. So things like patient support services, pricing and contracting strategies, and then reliability of the drug supply chain. So, you know, as a manufacturer, your toolbox is much more limited as to how you can, you know, pitch the value of this drug. And so it really relies on these few things, and makes it really, really important for these manufacturers to be, you know, to understand the market that they're entering and kind of get a hold of these things early on. I think, you know, you have to come to market being, you know, willing to provide at least the same level of patient support as the bio or as the reference product manufacturer. And so, again, it's those things that we talked about that make it really challenging, because you know, you have a product that doesn't really have any defining attributes other than being just as good as its neighbor. So that's certainly a huge concern for, or a problem for biosimilars, but I don't think there's a simple solution for it.
How can stakeholders address the education gap among healthcare providers, patients, and payers regarding biosimilars?
Yeah, so this one, I really, when I thought about it, we talk so much about education, and as I stated before, it's kind of easy to say, oh, they need to educate to know more, about something and increase its use or make it more well known. But I think the piece when I thought about it that's missing is an incentive, right? When think about if you're in school, your incentive to study was to get a good grade on the test and get a good outcome that way. But then when the teacher would say, here's this part of the lecture where I'm going to teach it to you just for your knowledge, it's not going to be tested upon. Oftentimes it's just going to get glossed over. You'll hear it, you might look at it, but you're not going to study it. And so what a lot of this education will end up being is kind of that garbage in, garbage out, because there's no incentive tied to it. And so, I don't want to be too specific here on what specifically that should be, because I think it depends on, who's hearing it. And I don't think that this is really something that manufacturers can necessarily provide as an incentive. So that's where we need to have a coordinated effort from the healthcare system and legislation to help push the envelope for biosimilars. Like I mentioned, the Inflation Reduction Act, they're increasing reimbursement rates for biosimilars. That's something that's going to get providers' ears to perk up and maybe make them think a little bit harder and want that education that can be delivered about biosimilars. Because, in the healthcare system, everybody's very busy, particularly providers. But I think if you talk to payers as well and patients, everyone lives has important things in their life, and usually learning about biosimilars is not the most important thing. And so I just really think that we need to find a way to make it attractive to want to learn more and just provide the incentives, and then the education will come along with it because people will have a reason to listen. So
In what ways can biosimilar pricing strategies influence payer uptake and market penetration in the US healthcare system?
yeah, so again, speaking to one of those three kind of strategic levers that biosimilar manufacturers can pull, and that's pricing. And so what we've seen so far, particularly with things like the Humira market landscape, is that there's kind of two strategies, right? Offer a high list price that's usually, maybe 5 to 10% less than the branded product, but you're also going to rebate to a level that we would assume would be similar to the branded product. The other strategy is offering a significantly lower list price with no rebate, and pitching the advantage that you're lowering overall cost of care. So again, when you kind of cut through that, the ultimate number that's going to be looked at is the net price. And so I think that's really what it's going to come down to. When we talk beyond just biosimilars and we talk about a standard branded product, maybe small molecule that has generics coming to market, again, that's what you're going to hear that they're looking at is that net price. And so, I think that biosimilars coming to market, obviously need to be aware of that. But I think the important caveat here that I'll go back to is that when we talk about, uptake and market penetration, what we're seeing and what we're expecting from the market research that we've conducted at Cencora is that, payers are typically looking to cover two biosimilars on formulary. And in our research, less payers selected the option to cover three or more biosimilars. And so this can limit that competition that's really going to result in significant price reductions. Usually when one generic or biosimilar comes to market, we see a fair bit of erosion in the branded product, sometimes as much as 50%, but it can even be maintained as much as 80% market share for the branded product. And then when you have the next biosimilar generic, that's when the pricing erosion really starts to begin. And you only see that after you have two. So that leads me to believe that's why payers, they're wise too, that they want to kind of induce some of that pricing competition. But I think you would see even more pronounced competition that could result in even bigger price reductions if they had, three, four, or five biosimilars covered on formulary. However, that's not exactly what we're seeing. And so, kind of coming back to that pricing discussion I talked about and the different options, when you ask this question, that those things are going to happen, but they're only going to happen so much when you only have a couple of the biosimilars on formulary. So, this is sometimes called the race to the bottom, and I want to be clear that that's not always a good thing either. Sometimes it could actually, prevent options, and manufacturers will pull out of those situations because there isn't money to be made. And so I want to be clear that that's not necessarily the intention, but I think that if we really want to see bigger price erosion, or market share erosion from the branded product, that they really need to push to put a few more biosimilars on formularies.
It's interesting that you mention race to the bottom pricing. We've obviously seen this with some European tender systems where they may be one winner and companies pull their products from the market, and then you have a drug shortage problem and it causes all these kinds of issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And you draw it on a really good point that I didn't quite think of as well, is the shortage, right? It's not only that, you want options, because if you don't have options, cost can then rise because you have the monopoly market. But even more importantly, to care for patients, you need to have a couple options, because you can't always 100%, rely on a reliable drug supply for various reasons. And so it's definitely important to have multiple. And so it's just finding that balance, striking that happy medium. And I think just my personal opinion is that if you have, multiple on market, it will stabilize. And so you don't want to necessarily limit it to just a couple.
What role do outcomes-based contracts and risk-sharing agreements play in
Yeah, so
facilitating payer
unfortunately, I'm
acceptance of
not sure there's going to
biosimilars?
be a huge role to play here for these types of contracts. I think it's because, if this was something that was attractive, the reference product might have already done it. It would have to be something really, really innovative and really well done. And I think that just the overhead and the effort needed to implement these types of contracts, that it might not be worth it in the end, or at least it might not be attractive for a manufacturer or even a payer, because that's kind of the general problem with these types of agreements in general, is that they're just tough to implement. So although, they're a great way for us to transition to a value-based healthcare system, I think that's that right there is the reason why we don't see more reference product and innovative therapies, when they come to market implementing these. Now, of course, it depends what type of therapy it is. If it's a cell and gene therapy type biologic, then yes, you might want to think about that. But I think just for a standard biosimilar, they're just looking to do what the branded product did. So maybe in those situations, if there is a biologic that already has, outcomes-based or risk-sharing agreements in place, and the payer finds those attractive, it might force the biosimilar manufacturer's hand to recreate something similar just to get on formulary. But I think that would be more of even a defensive tactic from the brand manufacturer to do this, because again, the biosimilar is going to do everything the branded product did. And hopefully it's going to do it for a little bit less money. And so I just don't see a huge incentive to, undergo the risk and the overhead of going into an outcomes-based agreement or a risk-sharing agreement, because it's just, they could just as easily come to market with maybe a lower price or something else in the contracting that's much more simple to implement that would make them the most attractive option, compared to their reference branded product. So, I guess to be determined, we'll see. Maybe I'll be wrong, but that's just my take on these.
What are the economic implications of biosimilar adoption for healthcare systems, including
Yeah, I think the
potential
impact
cost savings and
ultimately
budget
will be
impacts.
significant and only continue to grow. I think, since 2015, when the first biosimilars entered market, there it created a lot of enthusiasm. And I think, I wasn't there. I was, still in high school at the time, but I think it created a situation where people might have expected to, have this look like the generic market. And it was really optimistic because that was the first, that era was kind of the first time where we started to see more of these complex medications in more prevalent diseases, and being used pretty widely in healthcare. And I think that there was an urge to kind of contain that and keep prices under control. And so, I just don't think that it was realized all the complexity and nuance that would go into this. And so, I mean, we've already seen reports of tens of billion dollars saved in this first kind of about 10 years of biosimilars in the market. But the estimates I've seen is that number is expected to, 5 to 10x in the next 5 years alone. So, significant increase in the expected savings of biosimilars in a much shorter amount of time. But I think, we need to be realistic about what those savings, can be versus what they're actually going to be, because there's just, so many barriers that we talked about already of, the reasons that these aren't being widely adopted. And so, I think that there's a lot of promise, but there's still quite a bit of challenges. And I think, just to tie it together, I think, biosimilar first strategies for new start patients, getting rid of, I guess it's two ways you look at it, either get rid of interchangeability or make everything interchangeable. But either way, I think that that's, a pretty significant barrier that's in place right now. Broader formulary coverage, where multiple products, more than, two maybe, are being covered, giving more incentives to patients and providers to make these switches. And then, just continuing to find legislative ways to incentivize the use of biosimilars.
Well, Dr. Noonan, thank you for sharing your insights with us. And thank you to our listeners for tuning into this episode of Not So Different. You can find additional information on everything we discussed in the show notes. And until next time, you can visit us at centerforbiosimilars.com.